We like to talk about food this time of the year. Maybe it's an attempt to pass the many dark hours. Maybe we're just fattening up for winter. Whatever the driver, let's hop in and take a spin. Our first guest today wrote a cookbook called Southern Soups and Stews, more than 75 recipes from burgoo and gumbo to etouffee and fricassee. Nancy McDermott is the author. She's a food writer and cooking teacher born and raised in North Carolina. She's written a series of books about Southern cuisine, including a book on Southern pies, for which she joined us on The Exchange 5 years ago. Nancy McDermott, good to have you back.
Oh, Jeff, it's great to be back. Pies to stews, we're going backwards, but eat dessert first. That's okay.
That's a way we like to have things happen, for sure. I want to point out, anybody who's rolling their eyes about soups and stews needs to know that there's lots of stuff in here you actually can eat with a fork, right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, to me, I decided, you know, it's my book, so I get to decide, what does curry mean? What does, you know, what is a cake exactly? So I said stew is a verb. So I've got things in here like jambalaya, which is actually a dry dish. It's, you know, it ends up being a rice dish that you eat with a fork, but it is stewed. You start out in a big pot and you get those, you know, the garlic and the onion and the seasonings going, and you cook a long time. So a stew is often a big spoon requiring thing, and of course I've got soups in there too, but there's a lot of things where stew's a verb. So I open up the kitchen. I don't shut it down.
So there's a whole mishmash of different regional and ethnic backgrounds in the South, a gumbo if you prefer. I mean, can you actually count the distinct cuisines that exist in the southern United States?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, you could, although you'd get the basic ones. So the low country is a coastal South Carolina and Georgia and the Sea Islands. And the Tidewater is up in Virginia and into the Chesapeake Bay. And I'm in the upper South, North Carolina, Virginia. There's the Mountain South, the Appalachian, the Blue Ridge, the Smokies running through, you know, which goes across many, many states. Louisiana, my gosh, you've got Cajun, you've got Creole, you've got city, you've got country. It's not where you line them up in a mathematical way, but I think when we talk about Southern food, it's really valuable to think about we're talking about a community of communities, and not about, you know, getting it down mathematically to this is this and that's that. The lines are always blurry.
Are soups and stews part of all of those different cuisines, though?
Absolutely. I mean, I could do a Cajun soups and stews book. I could do a Low Country soups and stews book. My problem was not coming up with recipes. It was, you know, it was paring it down and trying to decide what are categories. So something like gumbo and Brunswick stew and shellfish and seafood, those were really easy categories to get. In some of my previous books, like in my cake and pie books, I had a sort of mountain region and coastal region. And in this book, things were, with soups and stews, things aren't as clear. I have a seafood chapter, but half of the seafood shellfish dishes start with bacon or ham hocks or some kind of salty pork. So it's as I said, it's where everything sort of blurs and stirs together. And remember, the food never knows about the lines on the map. So we say, well, this is Thai and this is, you know, Laotian and this is Chinese, but people are, you know, this is Israeli or this is Palestinian. It's like, you know, the food goes where the food goes and cooks cook it. And so when we step back and say, well, this is this and that's that, we're like guides. We're saying, go to this place, it's really great, but we shouldn't be saying this is what this is. And the word authentic just gives me the heebie-jeebies, because, you know, so quickly we end up saying, well, we're saying this is real and not real. And all any of us are saying is, I like this, I'm interested in that, here's what I found out. And I like our food conversation to be, you know, inclusive and joyful and not, you know, not pedantic.
It's almost like the old tuna commercials. If we're not looking for good taste, we're looking for things that taste good.
Yes, exactly. That still works.
Nancy McDermott's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Southern Soups and Stews. You can join us 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So gumbo it is in Chapter 1. Are gumbos generally from Louisiana?
Well, I would say the ones, the star that we know the best is the one that, God rest his soul, Chef Paul Prudhomme, really introduced to the world, which is a Cajun gumbo with a rich, dark, cooked a long time roux, which is just oil or fat and flour cooked until it's dark colored and rich and toasty flavored. And then there's what he called the Trinity, green pepper, celery, and onion are stirred in for flavor. And then it could be duck, it could be chicken, it could be gumbo crab, seafood, almost anything meat and seafood could go into a gumbo, and then lots and lots of times andouille sausage, something like that. And it's a dark concoction. It's traditionally served with rice. And, of course, there's also that Cajun sub-tradition of serving gumbo with potato salad, with a Creole potato salad, which is creamy, and they love that. And I think that's the one we know because he went on Good Morning America, and he was a wonderful teacher and explainer, and he wrote a magnificent book, which would make a great present for anybody who's interested in that kind of cuisine, Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen. So when we say gumbo, I think that's what most people think of. But there was gumbo in the Low Country in South Carolina and Charleston and in Savannah and in the Sea Islands either the same time or possibly even before, because gumbo, when you're in the tidewater in the Low Country, there's no roux. There's no salty porky products. It's a soup that almost always has okra, gumbo being one use of the word gumbo is it's a Bantu word. Language word for okra, which is a gift of African cuisine. And so the first gumbo in the book is my friend Natalie Dupree's, the second one, Natalie Dupree's Low Country Okra and Shrimp Gumbo. And it is, it's a beautiful still life picture of it. And there's bacon grease, okra, onion, celery, green peppers, garlic, tomatoes. You wouldn't have tomatoes in a Cajun gumbo. Shrimp stock, and shrimp and green onions, and it's over rice. So there's none of that feisty, fiery seasoning that we find in Cajun cuisine. It's maybe a little bit more like a Creole gumbo, which usually has tomatoes. That's the sort of old New Orleans Creole community. So it's like it's alike, but it's not alike. So what I wanted to do was kind of open it up. I mean, I've got one of my favorite gumbos is the very last one in this chapter. Let's see. It is Abby Fisher's okra gumbo with beef and rice. Beef shanks, salt, pepper, okra, rice, and parsley, and, of course, lots and lots of water. And that's called a gumbo, and that's from where gumbo means it's a soup with okra in it. So, you know, so when I do a book, I want to say, look what I found when I opened this treasure chest, and not, you know, those other things, that's wrong and that's right.
What are some of the best techniques then, Nancy? I noticed all the okra in there. And so what are some of the good techniques to give okra its own distinct flavor and not come out with that slimy sort of greasy thing that can happen to okra?
You know, I'll tell you, there's one brilliant thing that I had completely overlooked until I started researching. And this is something that there's a book called Creole Feast by the late great Dr. Rudy Lombard. And he was a culinary historian and a civil rights activist and a scholar. And he spent a lot of his life in New Orleans. And he wrote this book, I think it's in the 1980s. And it's 15 Creole New Orleans chefs share their secrets. And in there, he interviews African-American chefs, Creole chefs, and men and several women. And several of them talk about when you start a gumbo, that you begin by cooking the okra. And so they heated the oil and they put the okra in and cooked it for 10 or 15 minutes until it got sort of dry and lost. I don't know if they were doing it to change the texture, but it changes its texture. And then the other ingredients go in. So there ends up being okra in that gumbo, but not in a way that somebody who says, I don't like it, would not like. And I thought, well, where did that technique go? It didn't go anywhere. It's just that I was always looking at the Paul Prudhomme Cajun kind, and they don't do that. I would say that if somebody doesn't care for okra's natural qualities, usually in a gumbo, it just goes in, and that's going to be part of it. But, you know, you don't really, when you're cooking a gumbo and there's okra in it, there's so many other things going on. It cooks a long time. There's lots of sauce. So I think a lot of times people may have a wonderful gumbo and, you know, not even notice that it's there. But the thing with doing your own gumbo is, if you don't like it, leave that out. We are not the police coming to say, did you add the tomatoes or not? That's the great thing about cooking. I'm giving you a map. I'm saying, here's how you get to the beach. And if you say, you know, I'm tired of this interstate, I'm not in a hurry, let's see where this road leads us, you take that side trip. You make it work for you. That's what cooking's always been.
Yeah, feel free to explore just a bit. Southern Soups and Stews is Nancy McDermott's book. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Brunswick Stew in chapter number 2 here. I understand there's some argument over the origin of Brunswick Stew between Georgia and Virginia.
Yes, and I'm in North Carolina, which is right in between the two, and so we're kind of like, you know, standing at the, you know, watching the tennis ball be batted back and forth. North Carolina doesn't really worry about it too much. The classic Virginia Brunswick stew is, let's see, page 40, and this is actually the heart of the book, having this experience that I write about on page 40 of going home with my friend during college days to Reedsville, North Carolina, where her father made Brunswick stew every fall for their family, just for a big family group.
Wow, and 24 pounds of hens, holy cow.
Yeah, because they were going to eat it all winter long. He had a giant cast iron pot that he pulled. I'm sure it was an old wash pot from a time when there wasn't a washing machine in the utility room. And the first thing to do was help my friend Debbie Gooch's mother pick the chickens that she'd cooked. They kept the broth, and we pulled away the bones and the skin, and there was all this cooked chicken. And then the next morning early, he put in the cooked chicken meat, and he put in beef and broth and lots of water and cooked it till the meat just fell apart, and then added tomatoes and onions and lima beans or butter beans, corn, and one chili pepper. Isn't that hilarious? One chili pepper.
Really?
He added some margarine. There are recipes that would add a little bit of Worcestershire sauce, but it's a pretty simple, very plain, satisfying, and the cooking technique is stir and stir and stir for hours with a paddle. I mean, it has to be something the size of an oar to move that around. And the story is you cook it until the paddle or spoon will stand up in the middle, you know, so that it's thick enough that you could eat it with a fork.
Uh-huh.
And that making of Brunswick stew, you still see it, Jeff. If you ride down through the countryside of North Carolina and Virginia and this, you know, middle Piedmont part of the South, you'll see a sign, stew, Saturday, 11 a.m., $5 a quart. And you better get there early because things will absolutely sell out, and people serve it with saltine crackers, and people buy two or three quarts and take it home. And then on some February night when you don't feel like cooking, you've got this wonderful, simple, homey stew that's ready to just heat up, and, you know, that's dinner. You could have a salad, but we traditionally do not.
Right, yeah. There's enough vegetables in there, it sounds like. And what's a burgoo, right, Nancy?
Burgoo, and I will correct you, the way they say it in Kentucky, which is Burgoo's home, is Burgoo.
Burgoo, okay.
And where did that name come from? Nobody really knows. The thing that makes most sense to me is that it's a variation on ragu, burgoo, something that's cooked a long time. But it's very similar to Brunswick stew, but more complicated. I mean, if you look at the recipe, they've got okra in there, they've got cabbage, they've got seasonings, and the most interesting thing to me about burgoo is it includes mutton, not lamb, mutton. So there was a time when there was a population of sheep and old sheep in Kentucky that we, you know, didn't have in North Carolina. So they've got the chicken, the mutton, the beef, the pork, tomatoes, onions, cabbage, bell pepper. There's just more to it. But I'll tell you what, when you make it and you stir it all up and it's cooked for hours, it's very similar. It's not about, you know, a deep, strong flavor like, say, gumbo is. It's about hearty, satisfying, autumnal richness. And I did include, you know, for this one, serves 25 to 30. That's an indoor size. You need a big pot. This is the kind of thing that people cook at church. In fact, I'd say in Kentucky, I would imagine not that many people make it at home, because there's a time when, especially Catholic churches, as a fundraiser throughout Kentucky, will have their burgoo day, and it's often paired with barbecued mutton. So you go, you get your plate, which would be like a shallow stew plate, soup plate, like an Italian soup plate, of burgoo, and you get a barbecue mutton sandwich on the side, and I think you don't need to eat dinner that night. I think you've had your meal for the day when you have that.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. Wow. When I first opened the book, it fell open to the chapter on shrimp and crab, and I didn't want to leave. Let's talk in specific about shrimp and grits with tomato and bacon. This sounds really good.
Oh, my gosh. And it is so simple. And that is, you know, that's sort of the darling dish of the modern Southern kitchen. When the food writer Bill Neal wrote his landmark book, Southern Cooking, in 1988, something like that. It was around the same time that Alice Waters was back from Europe and was talking about, you know, well, you know, seasonal cooking and how they eat in France. And Bill Neal was a North Carolina native, and he'd grown up on a farm, and he was looking at Southern food, and like, you know, as Edna Lewis also, who's the other, who's the great messenger of saying, Southern food is not broken. Southern food is seasonal. It's, you know, fresh and eating out of the garden and respect for ingredients and using everything up. And regardless of what they're, you know, calling Southern on the Food Network, here's this traditional cuisine that has lots of tomatoes and lots of corn. And so shrimp and grits came out of the Low Country. That's particularly South Carolina, Charleston area. And the most original form of shrimp and grits is called breakfast shrimp. My friend John Martin Taylor wrote a wonderful book called Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking, if somebody's interested in low country food. And then he talks about breakfast shrimp, and that's when people who lived along the water would go out and catch little tiny shrimp, little small shrimp, at the water's edge and bring them in and cook them and put them in butter and have those over grits. Now, Bill Neal got more adventurous and added some salty pork products and some tomatoes. And my friend Bill Smith, who's the chef of Crook's Corner in Chapel Hill, still cooks Bill Neal's signature version, which has sliced mushrooms and sausage. But I went with a simple one. You can make this. It's practically out of the pantry. Bacon, onion, and garlic. You cook the shrimp. Fresh or canned tomatoes. Canned tomatoes work wonderfully in this. If I had a wonderful fresh ripe tomato, I would just eat it on a tomato sandwich. I wouldn't cook it in shrimp and grits. And parsley and basil, green onions, pepper, and grits. And I've got a recipe for grits in the back of the book. And I've also got a grits casserole, which has some cheese in it. And a lot of times people will do shrimp and grits for a brunch, and they'll have a grits casserole and a big bowl of this shrimp cooked with tomatoes. And it's really simple to put together, and it's lovely, and it's festive, and it just fits in with any menu that you want to have.
You know, for a small soft cover book, you've packed a lot of stuff into Southern soups and stews. It's and I can see how. It's just been great to have you back on the show and go on at length about the stuff you got in here. Nancy McDermott, thanks again for joining us to talk about Southern soups and stews.
What a privilege. I hope your holidays are wonderful, Jeff.
Thanks. Yours too. Take care.